This is Jim Hightower with my little pops of populism every single day, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff. We replay an interview from earlier this year with host Teresa Wilkie. She spoke with Michael Kay, Professor of Law Emeritus at Washburn University, about his work with the police and school administrators in the Topeka School District to define the role of police officers in their schools. Then, host Keith Washburn talks with Mindy Figuerino, the Impact Reentry Specialist with Avenue of Life. She will give the perspective of someone working with people at the back end of the school-to-prison pipeline, looking back at the beginning of the pipeline. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and our new feature at the end of the broadcast, Letters from Inside. Now, here is Teresa and her guest.
I want to welcome everyone to Jaws of Justice. I'm happy to have as my guest Michael P. Kay, Washburn University Law Professor Emeritus. Michael, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, first of all, I don't have a middle name, but thank you for giving me one. It's Michael Kay, but I will tell you about myself. I taught at Washburn since 1979, where I was a teacher in the law clinic and in the classroom, and in criminal law, criminal procedure, evidence, and trial advocacy. So my interest has been in community justice, in alternative dispute resolution, and labor law. And so I spent most of my time doing that until I retired about a year ago, at which point I got involved with the 501 school district here in Shawnee County. I had been the chair of the Topeka Police Department Grievance Review Board, which heard appeals by police officers regarding either contract issues or discipline issues. And that's how I got to know Major Ron Brown, who was one who helped me administer it. And he left the department, he retired, and he became the chief of the 501 Police Department. So at that point, I met him again and asked him if he'd like me to help out with the new Juvenile Justice Reform Act that came into effect in 2016, in July. And he welcomed me, and thanks to that, I've spent the last year training officers, observing them in the school setting, and learning a lot about MOUs and about the juvenile justice system. And we drafted an MOU this year as a result of this new act, which I greatly support.
Well, Michael, that is nothing short of fabulous. And for our listeners, let's have a clear understanding. Unified School District 501 is in Topeka, Kansas. It's in Shawnee County, Kansas. And our topic today is the pipeline to prison. We have a clear understanding that unequal opportunity within the public school district causes this pipeline to prison to occur. The term has emerged from our observation of the modern criminal justice system, where our understanding of the statistics on the impact of repeated involvement with the criminal justice system displays racial disparity in the statistics. And we know the problem of suspended futures when applied to children. There's a clear correlation between education and prison. Michael, explain how you became interested in this topic.
Well, I think that as a lawyer, especially a lawyer dealing with constitutional law and criminal justice issues, you can't not be interested, really, in the sociology of this, you know, why some people end up in prison, others don't, how where you go to school, what your family is like, affects your entry into the justice system at a time when, for other people, the entry is into college. And so I was also active in the ACLU for a number of years, and I just seemed to me to be very interesting. And Actually, I couldn't explain to you really, but when I saw that there was a new Juvenile Justice Act, it struck me that just standing there talking to Ron was that was the way I could be helpful. And so that's sort of what brought me into it. You know, I think that from my own point of view, when we talk about racial and ethnic disparities, we're talking about percentages. We're talking about different treatment for similar behavior between students of color and students who are not of color. We're talking about an unnecessary entry, for example, into the justice system and deeper penetration even. And that usually, I think, what I've seen is the result of criminalizing normal adolescent behavior and sometimes simply school misbehavior, that because somebody thinks they don't want to tolerate that kind of behavior in the school, it gets thrown to the justice system. And this new statute is a remarkable redoing, recasting of our juvenile justice system. Kansas gets a lot of bad publicity. There's no question about it. I just, you know, the legislator that talked about African Americans having a genetic predisposition to using marijuana, shameful publicity across the country.
Step off the committee.
And it makes national publicity because we're known for it. But this statute is remarkable, and it was passed with 100% of the votes in the Senate, 188-5 vote in the House in Kansas, signed almost immediately by the governor, and it was the result of the legislature putting together a work group of made up of a large number of stakeholders in the justice system, legislators and prosecutors, judges, defense lawyers. This couldn't have been done better. And it's incredibly ambitious. So now the story is going to be, will it work? And for it to work, there has to be collaboration. So all this, you know, makes me very interested.
This is where you come in. I found you looking at a Capital Journal article, the Topeka Daily Capital Journal, mm-hmm. where you're the author of a model memorandum of understanding between the school district in Topeka, Kansas, and the police. So you're offering this model memorandum of understanding to all school districts in Kansas to adopt. Is that correct?
Well, in a way it is. In the first place, I think you should, let me just, for your listeners, they might want to understand what an MOU is and how I got involved in it and our district got involved in it. Memoranda of understanding are not a new device. They're not a new type of agreement. Memorandums of understanding is an agreement between agencies and people who are working together. It's not supposed to be a legally enforceable agreement. It's an agreement based on trust. Some of them are like contracts, and they might actually be enforceable in a court. But basically, the actual idea behind them is that people who are working together sort of pledge to trust each other and work this out, sort of a cooperative plan. And the new Juvenile Justice Reform Act requires school districts to develop and approve what they call the Memorandum of Understanding. And not only do they, each one has to have one, and they had to have one by July 1st of 2017, this thing had to be developed in collaboration with what they called relevant stakeholders. So, for example, it would be between the school district and a law enforcement agency, the district attorney's office, the Department of Corrections. It could include community groups like the NAACP, neighborhood associations. And it's up to the school district who the stakeholders would be. And the purpose of this MOU is clear guidelines for how and when school-based behaviors are going to be referred to law enforcement or to the juvenile justice system. And the statute says, with the goal of reducing such referrals and protecting public safety. So when I saw this, I and Ron got together to work on this, and I went and took webinars, for example, from the leader in MOU production, Judge Teske in Clayton County, Georgia, who goes around the country helping districts to design their MOUs. And all these MOUs are considered to be unique to the district. So, for example, Garden City might have a very different type of MOU than Topeka would have. So we worked on that. And then we got the general counsel for the Topeka 501 district to work with us on it. And among us, we developed a draft. We then talked to the new superintendent and asked her to convene a meeting of stakeholders. And so then we had prosecutors, we had the presiding judge of the district, we had corrections people, we had people from the school district. And that's when we discussed this particular draft that we had to see if we could get buy-in. And then after we had done that in one large group, we met again in small groups, we worked on the language, and out of that came this collaboration that produced this MOU. Now, as far as other people go, we are overjoyed if anybody wants to use it and, adopt it or change it. But for all I know that Wichita, for example, has one. Their school system is very advanced when it comes to this stuff. And there may be others that have them also. But we're willing to share it, absolutely.
Each individual school district would have to sign a memorandum of understanding with their local law enforcement.
I don't know whether Missouri has done this or not. This is entirely a state law thing.
We can only encourage them.
Encouraging them to do it?
Right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, here's the reason, and I'll tell you. One thing that's very important to understand is there was a Bar Journal article by a juvenile court judge who says it's a whole new world now. And he describes this new act as a complete redoing, almost unbelievably vast redoing of the justice system and the juvenile justice system. And the purpose of this, the primary absolute purpose, is to reduce racial disparities and to keep all kids out of the justice system unless they absolutely have to be there. And to make that work requires buy-in from a huge bureaucracy, in other words, and from the public. And so for that to work, the MOU is extremely important, because the MOU is something that will be in the hands of teachers, school administrators, parents can read it, the police department, the school police department.
The sheriff.
And kids know about it. This is a thing that will make it run. In other words, they're like the engineering department at GM, and this thing is the car. You know, this is the operating manual for the car, and that's how we're doing it.
Right. We see the trigger of racial disparity in offenses, the number of offenses. There's a disproportionate number of black students charged with suspensions compared to their general overall school population. And there's two things that I found in my research that cause this. One is a zero tolerance policy, an exclusionary policy. Here's the rule. Anyone who does this is suspended. And then the other is, in fact, the policing in schools. So in the modern world, we have police officers in schools. And as a result of this, we're seeing more incarceration of youth because the police have been misused in public school. So the MOU is getting away from the idea of a police officer as a hall monitor. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, number one, yes, zero tolerance policies are inconsistent with the new law. There's no question about it. Not only that, we're not writing on a clean slate here. It's well known that zero tolerance policies feel good to people not involved in the application of the policies, but they not only don't do anything, but they don't do what they're supposed to do. They don't prevent recidivism, and they also end up being quite cruel. As far as policing in the schools go, I would say this. During this last year that I've been involved with this, I've had a chance to see police at work. So, for example, I've spent time with the officers in the 501 police department in the high schools and the middle schools, you know, shadowing them and seeing how they deal with that. I've also participated in training them in effective interaction with students and with school staff. And we've put on about four training sessions through our own 501 police department on this very issue, not only in our school but elsewhere. And what I've found is that, first place, police are used to being trained. Training is an important part of their work, self-training. They treat kids out here with respect. They mentor them. They're not looked upon as the enemy. And they are the one group, I would say, that is most likely to understand and treat all kids appropriately, regardless of economic or racial issue. Now, when it comes to the schools, here's the problem. And you see this not only here, but in other states. Once a police officer's in the school, the officer's in a somewhat delicate position because they're there for safety purposes. And safety means that they'll problem solve, but they're there to prevent crime, and if there is crime occurring, to stop it or investigate it. What do school teachers think about that? Well, some school teachers understand it perfectly. Others don't. And the problem that this law is intended to address, and you see it in our MOU also, is police should not be asked to do school discipline, which is the province of administrators and school staff. In other words, if a teacher is having trouble with a kid who won't put his cell phone away, you don't call the police officer in and say, take that away from him. If you're having trouble with a kid in the classroom who just won't listen or who keeps on talking and who's violating school regulations, behavior, you don't call the police officer in and say, get him out of here. And this problem, unfortunately, throughout the country, is one that police are very sensitive to because they see, you might call it mission creep. They see the school encroaching on their, taking advantage, really, of their presence to try to use them for something they're not intended to do. And Ron Brown and I wrote an article that's coming out in February in the Kansas Association of Police Chiefs magazine about this, because once a police officer is brought into the school classroom or the school environment, and a student starts to treat them perhaps in a way they might be treating a teacher, you know, rudely, unwilling to cooperate, maybe even pushing, the officer finds that they have to deal with that as a police officer because they're dealing, their authority is now being challenged. And what this can mean is that other kids seeing it are going to think, well, we don't have to listen to the officer. He's, you know, just, we can push him around too. So they sometimes have to take action. If they have to do that, they're now potentially going to detain a kid or arrest a kid, the one thing they don't want to do. So these problems are ones that the police are now used to facing, and the MOU should reduce that. Now, the other thing is causes of racial disparity, I don't think come, in my experience here, from these officers. We have our officers racially different. In other words, we have black officers, we have white officers, we've got officers who've got Asian background. But what happens is that kids are going to be pushed around, suspended, detained very often because school teachers don't understand what they're doing and think that a black kid, because they talk a certain way or act a certain way, is committing a form of school misbehavior that has to be responded to by some form of discipline. And that's one of the causes of racial disparity. You know, the only way to find out why you have racial disparity is to dig down, to try to investigate, talk to everybody, and find out why they're doing what they're doing, because we do have a black kid in Shawnee County is 4.5 times more likely to be suspended or sent to a juvenile intake than a white kid. There's an example of the type of process that you want to see in a community. In other words, this idea of collaboration means that since you're interested in community alternatives to detention and community input, you've got to go to the community and talk to them. So as it turns out, Ron Brown told me that there was going to be a movie shown about school-to-prison pipeline, and that they were having a panel, and they were going to have the superintendent on it. Ron was going to be on it. A former school board member would be on it and asked me if I'd like to join. So we're going to go there. We're going to talk. You know, we're going to see the movie, and we're all going to talk about it. And we hope, of course, just as you're suggesting, that the public is there, the people who care about this issue, and we can find out what they think, you know.
We have run completely out of time, and I thank you very much for being such an interesting and engaging guest. I thank you very much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Now, the calendar for the week of April 16th. The Mattie Rhodes Center invites you to the 8th Annual Brightening Lives, Building Futures Luncheon, Thursday, April 19th. Each year, thousands of children come to the Mattie Rhodes Center to find a safe base after school, a trusted mentor, healthy sports activities, and a creative learning environment. All proceeds from this event will help fund their youth development programming. To reserve your spot or for more information, email events@mattierhodes.org or call 816-581-5622. You can participate in the National Child Abuse Prevention Month by attending Camp Choice Sues the World on Behalf of Children, a court drama case to raise funds for Camp Choice Game of Life Weekend Adventures and Smart Scholarships. Join the jury Thursday, April 19th at Southeast High School, 3500 East Meyer Boulevard, KCMO. Doors open at 6 p.m. and the play starts at 7 p.m. For more information and tickets, email all capital letters campchoicekc.com or call 816-560-0977 or Smart Learning Centers at 816-612-1083. The KC Chapter of Mothers in Charge Healing Support Group will be meeting Thursday, April 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Robert J. Mohart Multipurpose Center, Suite 124 West. That's at 3200 Wayne Avenue, KCMO. This group is for people who have lost loved ones to murder and violence. The first hour will be sharing of experiences, and in the second hour, therapists and others who can help navigate the emotional and legal terrain will be available. For more information, you can find them on the web at kcmothersincharge.org or call them at 816-912-2601. Corey's Network and Chuck E. Cheese at 18701 East 39th Street, Independence, Missouri, are once again teaming up to help victims of murder on Friday, April 20th from 3 to 9 p.m. 15% of all purchases at the register, including food, merchandise, and token deals, will help pay funeral costs of a murder victim under the age of 12. You are invited to help out this good cause, and if you have information on a murder, call the TIPS hotline at 816-474-TIPS. That's 474-8477. Missouri and Indiana are the only two states in which a judge can give a death sentence if a jury deadlocks. Most states with the death penalty follow the federal procedure of an automatic sentence of life in prison if a jury cannot reach a unanimous decision. If you feel the Missouri legislature should restore the rightful role of the jury in capital cases, call your representative and senator and tell them to support House Bill 2459 and Senate Bill 996. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. And now we go to Keith and his guest.
All right, good morning. And we're continuing now with Jaws of Justice on KKFI. My guest this morning is Mindy Fugarino. We love that last name. Good morning, Mindy.
Good morning.
And Mindy is with she's the Impact Reentry Specialist at AOL, which stands for Avenue of Life. And I know those folks very well. I'm on the board of advisors over there. And how long have you been there?
About 5 weeks.
5 weeks. So fairly new there. But
right.
You've done reentry work and work with folks in prison for quite some time.
3 years recently at the Life Connections Program at the federal prison in Leavenworth.
All right. So we're going to talk this morning about the prison, what has been known as the pipeline to prison or the school to pipeline to prison. And also, I want to say, just starting out here, kind of tongue in cheek. So, Mindy, why are the police rounding up, picking up, arresting all these young black men in urban Kansas City, KCK and Kansas City, Missouri?
Wow. So that question in and of itself is loaded and intentionally so, but I think the way that it comes out is one of the things that keeps us from coming to solutions, because it's basically showing implied bias, implied assumptions about what the intent is behind the thinking of the police and somebody arguing it because they're upset with it or angry because it pushes their buttons. They're going to make their assumptions as well from the other direction. And basically both sides are, anytime we assume somebody else's motive or intentions, we're practicing closed thinking, which is one of the main thinking barriers that I work with from whichever direction you happen to be coming from to try to find solutions to actually not have a thinking barrier in the way of getting to where we all want to be.
So you're trying to help people change their thinking.
Yes.
Or have some resilience and change their thinking patterns. So once I get into the system, let's say that I've now gotten into jail for my very first offense, then that in and of itself, I'm part of a system that can, in a way, just keep me in the system if I don't change my thinking or if I adopt the thinking of the other people who have maybe the more hardened criminals that have been in lots and lots of times.
Sure. And I mean, I think before I say that, I do want to at least say that all of these thinking barriers are present inside the prison as well as outside the prison. So it's not just criminals who are exercising these, but certainly when they're exercising extreme, they make it more likely that somebody's going to end up committing a crime and be in jail. But yeah, if we can change that thinking, then we can tell somebody who is in the system or who is headed towards that prison pipeline, headed down that way, we can tell them you don't have to wait for society to make all of the changes that society should make, right, before you can succeed in life and before you can actually stay free and meet your goals and be a happy, productive part of this community, right? You don't have to wait for society to get everything right in order for you to do that, because each person has power within themselves to do that. That doesn't take away society's responsibilities, but it does, I think, at least give some hope so somebody doesn't have to say, I don't have any choice. This is where I was going to be no matter what.
Right, yeah. And it seemed like it's just hopeless and it's not not my responsibility to change my thinking patterns. That's overall what you're saying is, listen, every person, including people that are not in the prison system, we have thinking patterns that we can overcome.
Definitely. And I mean, I think that we've built quite a mess when it comes to that prison pipeline idea, that it's been something that we've been creating for hundreds of years here. And in order to do that, that means our society's been living in thinking barriers for a while. And it's going to take everybody coming to the table and saying, what am I going to do? What am I going to own? How am I going to be responsible for my own thinking, my own choices? How am I going to manage my emotions and be empathetic? And if I do that, then I can invite you to do it as well with me. And maybe we can actually find some solutions to this mess we've made.
Yeah, so. A great point. And let's say that even employers might have some thinking barriers. In other words, when these young black men get out of jail, it might be good that they had some opportunity, given
Definitely.
To them, to have a job, get a second chance, so to speak. So I know enough about Mindy that I know that she is into justice work. So we're saying this morning there's a lot of injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to concentrate this morning a little bit more on the solutions and the thinking barriers and that kind of thing. And we're also going to at least acknowledge there are a lot of injustices in our world. And Mindy and I both happen to be white. That doesn't mean we haven't both been exposed to and are both fighting against the injustice that are present. There are many injustices that are present. I think both of us probably agree on the point that the police, in many cases, are very biased. I'm not saying it's the majority of cases, but I'm saying there are too many cases where the police appear to be biased in the way that they handle situations yeah. with African Americans in particular. So, let's go on then with solutions. Hopefully we can talk about. And one thing we've talked about this morning before we went on air is the idea that these are our children.
Mm-hmm.
These are, we can say, well, those black kids down mm-hmm. in the urban core, and I'm, living in the suburbs here, and I don't have to worry about that. No, it's an issue that we all should be looking at and all trying to work together to find solutions for the pipeline to prison.
Right. I mean, what kind of society do we want to be, and what kind of people are we if we can't say that all these kids are our kids?
Exactly. And there's so much talent. That's the other thing. Having mm-hmm. I became exposed to this, and I may have mentioned this to you. I said this in a little blurb that we put out prior to the show, is that Sister Berta is the first one who said, Keith, we're running a feeder system to the prisons. She mm-hmm. called it a feeder system. And at that time, this was back in like 2003, 2004, that really perplexed me. Well, of course, now I see she was right on, as mm-hmm. she almost always is.
Yeah.
And that's how I got involved more and more with Sister Berta at Operation Breakthrough and then Freedom Fire and now with Avenue of Life. By the way, we want to say a shout out to all of our buddies over at Avenue of Life, Dr. Evelyn Hill, Desiree, Andre, mm-hmm. Billy, everybody, say a shout out. That's your where you're working these days, and they're doing a lot of good work.
They are. I mean, I think one of the things that they have done is correct some of the thinking that says that's other people's fault, that's their thing to fix. And they've said, here's what something we can do. We know that poverty has an impact. There's plenty of reasons to work against poverty and homelessness, right? But in terms of this show, if we're looking at things that influence the prison pipeline, poverty and homelessness are certainly part of that, and kids not being able to make graduation. And so you've got a school district in KCK that has basically said, our goal is 1,400 diplomas, because we had, a couple years ago, 1,400 homeless students within our school district. And so they've decided, no, we're going to get these kids all the way through. And so they have a memo of understanding with Avenue of Life to say, we're going to change this. We can actually solve this homelessness issue. There's no excuse. There's no reason. It's not okay for our kids to be homeless. And so they're doing it. And they've wrapped around 25 agencies that come in every week and collaborate around these homeless families. And so in two school years, we're in the third one, but by the end of the second school year of them doing these wraparound programs, they have reduced the homeless population in school district by 43%. And we've already, on top of that, resettled just this school year 110 families, and we're on track to hopefully settle 120 before the end of the school year. That's a lot of impact. So by 2020, the homelessness in the school district could be eliminated. And then we can be on to other things, and empowerment and prevention and all those kinds of things. But that's because people came together and said, this isn't okay, and we can do something about it. And that's one piece, I think, that helps with that prison pipeline. If we can get all those kids across the stage for graduation, that's going to be a huge empowering impact for them.
And give them a good education.
Yes.
Which is a good start in life. Much to the many of my, the kids that I graduated with, my contemporaries, if you will, we may have believed, oh, this isn't going to help us. Well, actually, it does. And it's a proven fact that a college diploma is better than a GED, for instance.
Yes.
That those people are going to be more successful. So it really is a good thing to get a good education, not just get a diploma, but get a good education while you're getting your diploma.
Right, and I think that's that is a goal, and part of that good education now is something that they've also declared with the program called Diploma Plus, we're not just trying to get you across the line academically and meet those standards, which matter, but our employers are all telling us that we want employees that actually have emotional intelligence, not just academic intelligence. In fact, we care more about the emotional intelligence. And so part of the Diploma Plus guidelines is we're actually going to empower young people to relate well, to actually have more power over their own emotions and their own lives, and be better employees as well as better employers as they go through life. So that's part of where I'm trying to intersect too, is to help build for kids and then across the community ways that we can get better emotional intelligence skills. I mean, so that we can actually have the self-awareness to notice, what am I feeling? How's that impacting me? What needs are going unmet? And then what am I doing with that in terms of how am I impacting others? But then also being able to look at you and say, I can kind of tell that you're feeling some kind of way, you know, and maybe I actually want to care about that and what needs that you have and respond compassionately. If I can do those things and improve and keep getting better at it, which we can do, then we're going to make people more successful in life across all the different aspects, not just school and career, but also life.
So it looks like we're getting a caller.
Okay.
And we didn't plan to take calls, but we'll take this caller anyway. But in the meantime, talking about the what you call EQ, mm-hmm. I don't know if we actually coined that mm-hmm. phrase, but IQ, EQ, so emotional intelligence, and the idea of empathy for other people, which is a big thing, mm-hmm. right? It's like, you know, you are actually, when you're out doing these crimes, you're hurting other people. It's stirring up their life, right? Even if you just steal something out of their car, that's something they're going to miss, and it's going to affect them, especially if they don't have the money to replace it. So, you know, that idea of having empathy for other people. And I guess we have a caller, Mike. Is that right? Mike Murphy's standing in and doing our engineering for us. Caller, you're on the air. State your name and the area of town you're calling in from.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to ask your guest a question. Now, you talk about the prison, the pipeline thing, from pipeline to prison. Here's the question. Generally, when people get out of prison, that felony record follows them, in, you know, into society, and then employers have access to that felony record. I feel like once you serve your time, the only people that should have access to the fact that you were a felon is the judicial system, the court system. They shouldn't be the only one, because when the public employers get access to that record, that inhibits them from hiring you. So why should they? If you served your time, why should the public have access to your criminal records? You know what I'm saying, right? Because even if you went out and committed another crime, the court system, who has access to your criminal history, which you may have a felony, they say, okay, let's go and arrest this guy every, you know. But to me, when the public gets access to your criminal history as far as felonies and stuff, all it does is inhibit you from being a productive citizen, because they may decide not to give you a job. So okay. I just feel like, once you serve your time, the public should not have access to your criminal history.
Well, thanks for calling.
If it's a felony.
No, that's a fair question, and we're gonna address that, Mindy.
Thank you.
I mean, I actually think that's an important concern, and probably not one of the ones that I'm in authority to make the decisions on at this point, other than I can vote and advocate. I think you're right that it's a huge problem that people coming out after having served their time, many of them students that I've worked with who have become really amazing human beings that I would be proud to live next door to, and they get out and it's much harder for them to get a job and enter the world of work, much less career. And yeah, so that barrier is something that's causing a lot of problems. Yeah. But and what's the solution? I think there's probably a variety of solutions.
And it also depends, I'm sure, on what their crime was. So mm-hmm. if they had a violent crime, then there are people who are going to absolutely tell us, and I think, you know, rightfully so, that they have a right to know that this person has perpetrated a violent crime, and that they, if they have not corrected their thinking, mm-hmm. they may indeed, you know, be willing to act on that again if they get angry at somebody or whatever. So there are some, you know, it's a very difficult thing, but I agree with the gentleman. This is an issue that, in Germany, for example, they're much more, it's more of a restorative sort of a thing. We want to put this person back in our community and keep them as one of our productive citizens, as opposed to punish them by putting them in prison and then further punish them because they can't get a job when they get back out of prison.
Right, or vote.
Yeah, they can't vote. They have no rights, essentially.
Yeah.
So it is a big difference in our country as opposed to, as I said, other countries like Germany.
Well, that also plays in, I mean, I think there's something we need to step back and learn from that, too, because our country actually imprisons a fourth of the world's prisoners. I mean, that's, and we do not have a fourth of the population by any far stretch.
Not even
so,
close.
If it does not seem to be working, the approach that we've had, and we do need to step back and say, what do we do differently? And I think a lot of the approach has been here in our country, an idea of changing people by fear, facts, and force. And there's a great book called Change or Die that talks about fear, facts, and force are not what work. That's not what changes people. That's not what changes motivations. That doesn't do any interior work. What it does is create a cycle of violence that pulls out the worst in other people. And instead of fear, facts, and force, we need to be learning how to relate and reframe and repeat. And so it's about connecting with people. And it's about, again, that emotional intelligence that says, I actually care what your unmet need is. I may not agree with you on how to get your need met, but I care about your need. And we can figure out together a solution. But until we're willing as a society to say, that's the kind of people we want to be. And we don't want to be this place that just imprisons people in the millions and billions. I mean, the exponential curve of imprisonment here is crazy. So we've got to step back and say, that's not working, so what will?
Right. Even with the most conservative, I'm talking about conservative politically now, person, it seems like a fairly good argument to say, how many more dollars do we want to pour into a prison system that's mm-hmm. already overbuilt?
Mm-hmm.
You know, by the world standards, as you said, we're employing a tremendous number of people, right? So it just doesn't make sense anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about the just something you said, unmet needs. I think that's a big thing, and I don't want to let that just slide by.
Sure.
Here is that in our particularly in our urban areas, mm-hmm. both KCK and Kansas City, Missouri, we have lots of people that just don't have a whole lot of options. You know, they don't have the opportunities that many kids have in the suburbs and in other areas of town. So right there, you see an unmet need to actually do something productive, to do something to contribute to the world. So say more about that.
Well, I mean, I think that any of us, whenever our needs aren't being met, I mean, just think about when you didn't get enough sleep or when you're hungry, and now everybody kind of jokes around the idea of being hangry because, I haven't eaten today and so now I'm angry. I hear lots of folks, of colleagues and friends saying these kinds of things. Well, that's real stuff. I mean, if the needs are unmet, that impacts our emotions, and our emotions are often the energy driving what's going on in our response to the world. So part of why I also advocate corrective thinking is because we can actually manage those emotions better. But if somebody's in trauma, they're actually wired, we're all wired as human beings in trauma to get ourselves to safety, to cope with this, to move through this, to survive. And our brain takes over in a way that the emotions are driving, and fear, fight or flight kind of things that are going on. And when we're like that, our frontal part of our brain is not active. We can't access that frontal cortex that makes the wise decisions and discerns what's best. And we're also not accessing a sense of concern for others because we're so concerned about our own survival in the moment. So if we're looking at a lot of people that haven't just been traumatized today, but may have been traumatized over a lifetime, and maybe their ancestors have been traumatized for centuries, then we're looking at basically folks who are, we're putting people in positions to have a very difficult time making the best decisions for themselves and the people around them. And if we can actually get better at caring about one another's needs, helping people identify their needs, then maybe we can actually get to that place of healing even. We've got a great guy that works well with trauma, particularly through a somatic approach, Matt Brandemeyer, who's partnering some with Avenue of Life. And just that idea of helping people move out of the fight or flight place and find some peace so that they can actually make the decisions that they need to make in their lives. That's, we got to be able to do that.
Yeah, the idea that trauma, early childhood trauma, so I had some information that I looked up last night, stored on my phone, but just any kind of trauma, mm-hmm. which includes, of course, sexual abuse, those kinds of things, but it also includes just living in a neighborhood where I'm hearing gunshots every night, or I'm actually an eyewitness to some violent crimes, you know, somebody beating another person or whatever. All that is traumatic for children. So I think we have another caller. Caller, you're on the air. State your name and area town you're calling in from. Are you there?
Hello, my name is Malcolm.
Hey, Malcolm. Thanks for calling in this morning.
All right. All right. So I have a question for you related to the previous caller's concerns about felony convictions or people who've been convicted of some kind of crime. And your response was that you would make an exception or that you would think that the public deserves to know about certain crimes, like violent crimes. And my question to you is, one, why is that fair if the person's consequence for violating some kind of law is to do time? That is a harsh consequence for the person who committed the crime, and that, to me, is sufficient. I would imagine if the the institution that incarcerates people is supposed to be there to punish. Well, that punishment has been administered, and they have served their time. But you are saying that it's acceptable to have a collateral consequence, which means that the public then can scrutinize this person and further ridicule them and ostracize them or just alienate them because they have committed something in their past. And so my question to you is, have you ever committed any kind of violent act? As a male growing up in a society that encourages you as a man to perform this thing called masculinity in violent ways, I'm sure that you have committed a violent act in your lifetime. And I'm not saying you've murdered or raped or robbed or stole or something like that, but I'm sure you've committed some kind of violent act. Should the public then know about your violent behavior in your past, if that is the case? And if not, you're probably supernatural and superhuman. But if so, shouldn't the public know about your actions?
Yeah, good question, Malcolm, and thanks for calling in. I did not say that my personal feeling was any certain way. I said what is going to happen is other people out there are going to say they have a right to know that. It's a very difficult issue. And yes, I would say that I have personally looked into my own, you know, actions and realized there are times when I've gone off the deep end and gotten angry and so forth. And you raise a very good point, which is, you know, here we have one, what I will call innocent young man in Kansas City who goes off the deep end and gets into a, you know, fight with somebody and ends up injuring that person. They go to jail for that. We got to wrap up because our show's about to end. But, you know, why do they deserve to be ridiculed, as you said, and suffer consequences for the rest of their life for that? It's a very, very good question. So I've got to wrap up. Mindy, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks,
Mindy
for having
Figueroa.
Me.
We had a couple of callers that we didn't expect, so we ran a little bit long, but you are listening to KKFI, and thank you so much for listening to Jaws of Justice.
On today's edition of Letters from Inside, we will hear from Santino Walker, a prisoner at the Southeast Correctional Center. In his letter of February 23, 2018, he writes, "I'm not sure if you've heard, but there's a new drug kingpin in town, and its name is the Missouri Department of Corrections. Everyone knows that to be successful in any trade, there has to be a supply and demand. As you know, it has been mandated that all tobacco and tobacco paraphernalia are to be banned from Missouri prisons by April 1st, 2018. All sales are to be stopped March 1st. Strangely, all sales stopped on January 1st. Then around the 1st of February, the institution informed the slave population that central office had approved the sale of tobacco at a price of $3.14 a pouch, which is up 15% from the previous selling price. This reminds me of the life I was exposed to as a teenager, drugs and how they destroyed my life and everyone's around me. The things that people are willing to do to obtain drugs, it's the same in here, except that the drug is tobacco. It's always been tobacco, They claim that marijuana is the gateway drug to all other illegal drugs. This is a lie perpetrated by the tobacco companies and supported by the government in exchange for a few dollars in taxes. The truth is that 90% of drug addicts started out with tobacco before moving on to other drugs. In this case, it's the addict that is punished, not the kingpin. Another anomaly noticed is the springing up of a number of classes here offering help to stop smoking. After April 1st, it's mandatory anyway, because all sales of tobacco will end. So why all the classes? The answer is money, to fund another meaningless money-making government program. After 23 years as a slave, I've realized that the biggest and the most powerful drug ever released upon the slave population was the vapor of hope. Even though we have the potential to monetarily cripple the system, most of us are easily distracted by mere talk of change, keeping the slave docile and incapable of doing what must be done to bring about this change. And while we're on the subject of money, most black intellectuals I've come across have made the argument that black people no longer hold any monetary value to the slaveholder. I strongly disagree. If this was the case, why are so many being re-enslaved? Slaves were once the source of wealth to the enslaver, still are. It's a fact that once the Emancipation Proclamation was set in place, those who were enslaved were never truly freed, not even physically. Anyone black caught out in the open could be kidnapped by any disgruntled Confederate and sold to the sheriff, who in turn sold the brother or sister back to the enslavers. Those who resisted were shot dead and left out on display. Today, those same enslavers are the coal mine companies, the railroads, the steel, and other corporations. So the bottom line is this: discipline is needed amongst the slaves. This includes the white guys too. You make up a small section of the slave community, but nonetheless, you share the black man's misery.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.